Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Now What? How to Move Forward When We're Divided About Basically Everything by Sarah Stewart Holland
and Beth Silvers.
Narrated by Sarah Stewart Holland
and Beth Silvers. To Nicholas and Chad, who keep us moving forward with their love and support.
We are like islands in the sea, separate on the surface, but connected in the deep. William James.
Introduction. Now what? It's the question we encounter more than any other.
The election is over. Now what?
We survived a disaster. Now what?
We had a terrible argument about politics and everything's awkward. Now what?
I tried to disagree graciously. Now what?
We talked it over, but it still feels like we live on different planets. Now what?
We all agree we have big problems to solve. Now what?
We started a podcast to talk about politics as citizens, not as pundits, journalists, or politicians. We wanted to hold ourselves accountable to a different way of communicating and, in the process, perhaps set an example that might be helpful to others. We've been at the work of grace-filled discussion since 2015. We've made hundreds of hours of podcast, written a book, and traveled the country talking with audiences in person about moving toward healthier relationships around politics. While it has been the most rewarding work of our lives, we won't lie to you. It can be hard to feel that we're making even the tiniest of dents in a political landscape that's driven by conflict.
In our first book, I Think You're Wrong, But I'm Listening, A Guide to Grace-Filled Political Conversations, we argued that we should all take off our partisan team jerseys. We wrote, "For most people who are passionate about politics, there are two teams. Democrats versus Republicans, conservatives versus liberals, right versus left. Many of us are born into one of the two and are taught by our parents and community that only one party could possibly represent our values. We put on our team jerseys and adopt the policies, positions, and politicians expected of us."
Several years later, we've realized that describing party identification as a jersey was a very optimistic metaphor. Party identity has become so strong, it can become even more important than identities used to define us as human beings. Father, sister, friend, American, church member, Christian. And some of us are now willing to sacrifice those other identities and the relationships that go with them on the altar of our political identity. Today, partisan jerseys feel less like clothing we can easily shed and more like a tattoo. It can come off, but the removal is a tough process.
We could write 50 books analyzing how we got here and why this polarization is harmful, but we don't think that's helpful. Plus, there are already loads of books on that topic. Paraphrasing author and speaker Byron Katie in Loving What Is, Four Questions That Can Change Your Life, we're welcome to fight with reality, but reality will always win. Accepting that some people are deeply wedded to their partisan labels, we also have to acknowledge that there are big questions our political parties will not be able to answer for us. And as critical as politics is to how we live in community together, it cannot be the only container for working out our identities and values. Plus, one of the cruelest aspects of this pervasive sense of constant conflict is the shrinking of our timelines. Anxiety and fear tell us that things are the worst they've ever been and cannot get better unless we go to war with each other. But the truth is, going to war with one another is a zero-sum idea. In war, either as a nation or between friends, someone has to win and someone has to lose. More conflict is not the answer. We don't think most of us are looking for victory. We're looking for connection.
As we spend time with people across the United States, conversations that often begin about seemingly intractable political conflict lead to deeper questions about separation. How do I know when my dad has become so toxic that I need to cut him out of my life? Does this mean it's time for me to get a divorce? Maybe I can't be friends with her anymore. They don't seem to accept me, so maybe I should just leave. From our listeners and readers, we see, hear, and feel a pervasive sense of loneliness. And it's not just within our community. From the nightly news to our social media feeds, a drumbeat of messages tells us that we can't do it. We are polarized, divided, strangers to one another. Those messages are disseminated through the lens of politics, but they resonate more generally. It's no wonder that loneliness and depression are rampant for individuals and that populism and nationalism are rampant for countries.
We are facing a new experiment in human history, And what we face is less a political question than a civic one. How do we live in diverse societies when the historical crutches of religion, ethnicity, or even geography are no longer as powerful as they once were? How do we find connection to one another when our differences are constantly on display? How can we strengthen our connections to one another when politics threatens to tear us apart? In other words, now what?
It's become so clear to us that most political conflict is wrapped around deeper emotional and spiritual dynamics. Dynamics that might be painful to examine, but that have the capacity to help us grow and heal far beyond partisan battles. In this book, we attempt to zoom out and see what larger issues are at the center of our political conflicts, whether they take place inside our families, our workplaces, our communities, our country, or our world. We've been intentionally practicing that mining process. What's underneath this conversation? How do we bring it into the light? How do we find something good in that light? We want to share what we've learned here in the hopes that you'll find new questions or phrases to help you dig deeper in your relationships.
To do that, we believe we have to re-examine all the levels of connection in our lives, from our families of origin to the entire human race with which we share this planet. We aren't going to be able to give you hard and fast rules at any of these levels.
Side note, we know everyone wants a quick and easy rule about ghosting your uncle on Facebook. It doesn't exist. We're sorry.
Here's what we hope to do throughout this book. Help us all see these levels of connection more clearly and the factors beyond politics that might be at play in those relationships. Share stories that help us know we aren't alone and from which we might be able to gain some inspiration. Draw on historic examples of connection to reorient us as family members, friends, colleagues, neighbors, and global citizens. Look to the future with our problem-solving hats on so that we can confidently and compassionately navigate our personal and civic challenges.
We know and experience the deep worry associated with pervasive polarization. This book is not intended to add to your worries. We want to relieve some pressure by saying as clearly as we can, we have urgent problems, and you don't have to solve them all because you are not alone.
This book is also not intended to guilt you into staying in toxic spaces. There are times when some level of separation is the right answer, whether that means separating from a person, a job, or an institution. We're here to help you ask questions about when to separate and when to stay. We're here to help you think about the impact of your connections. We don't want to focus only on your painful relationships. If we've learned anything since the beginning of our partnership, it's that building on the strength of healthy relationships creates so many possibilities and sustains us through tough times. We also write this book with an enduring and deep humility. We are experts only in our own experiences, and our experiences don't represent everyone.
We are as we seem on the surface, two middle-class white ladies, both former lawyers, both living in Kentucky, both happily married to men, both raising little kids. Despite these similarities, when we started our podcast in 2015, we felt like strangers to one another. We knew the loose outlines of one another's lives from our time together in college, and we knew we were, at the time, on different sides of the political spectrum. Our differences were on full display during a time in American history when differences were all that mattered. And yet, over the past 7 years, we have built a successful partnership and life-giving friendship together, not by avoiding our differences or conflicts, political or otherwise, but by connecting through them. That connection has allowed us to see both our politics and ourselves more clearly. It has allowed us to dig deep beneath the anger and the fear to the problems we face in our communities, in our nation, and in our world with a more complex and complete perspective. It has allowed us to work toward a solution together instead of trying to fix the problem on our own.
That's what we're inviting you to do in this book. We're inviting you to see the connections you hold with fellow human beings in a bigger way, from the people in your home you see every day to the people across the globe you never meet. We will begin with our closest connections, our family, our friends, our coworkers, and look at what political conflict can teach us about ourselves and others. Then, with fresh eyes, we hope to expand into the other connections we hold with our fellow human beings in our communities, states, nation, and world to see beyond the political morass to how we can continue on together.
Now what? We all want the answers to be, now we solve the problem. Now we all agree. Now we all stop fighting. But we all know deep down that is never going to happen. Instead, we're inviting you to see Now What not as an opportunity to solve conflict, but to use it to connect more deeply with the people around you.
Part one, those closest to us. The best way to examine our connections and what's keeping us divided is to start with those closest to us. In the first half of the book, we're going to look at our most intimate connections and what political conflict can teach us about what's buried deep beneath fights over Facebook and battles across the dinner table. We start with our families of origin and what generational expectations can help parents and children and siblings and even extended family understand about one another. We then look at our families of choice, our romantic mates, our parenting partners, those we have brought close to us by design, and think about what and who we're trying to control when we fight about our ballots or our candidates. Next, we take a moment to examine how caregivers talk to the children in their lives about politics. Spoiler, you already have everything you need for these conversations. Finally, we look at the other people in our day-to-day lives, our friends and our coworkers. Our closest friendships are so frequently built on similarity, our political views usually expose our differences. As we're learning to show up as our whole selves with family and friends, we examine how we can face our fears and do the same at work.
Chapter 1, Our Families of Origin, Don't Question Grandma, and Other Unwritten Rules. In the fall of 2019, Beth and I traveled to California for two live shows, one in San Francisco and one in Los Angeles. My dad has lived in California since I was 5 years old, and I spent most every summer of my childhood visiting him in the Golden State. However, Beth had never been out west, and I thought taking the Pacific Coast Highway between our two shows would make the most of our short trip. My dad is incredibly generous and loves to drive, so he volunteered to make the trip up and back from Bakersfield, where he lives, in one day. The three of us spent almost 12 hours together in the car, taking in the gorgeous coastline and eating lots of In-N-Out. My dad and I both love music, so we also spent a lot of time sharing new bands we'd found and singing along to 90s country, where our tastes consistently converge. It sounds lovely, doesn't it? A devoted father bonding with his daughter, surrounded by a panorama of blue skies and crashing waves, with Garth Brooks serenading us in the background. FYI, our DMs are closed to alternate opinions of Garth Brooks. Of course, the reality is more complicated. At that point in 2019, we were over 2 years into the Trump presidency. There had been 2 years of tweets and chaos. There had been 2 years of anger and fear and frustration for me. My dad voted for Trump proudly, and his continued support for the president had become a constant source of conflict within our relationship. For the majority of our trip, we steered clear of politics, as most American families were at least attempting to do at that point, if they were still talking at all. But Beth's presence and her recent change in party registration from Republican to Democrat was something my dad couldn't ignore. He knew where I stood, after all, but he seemed sincerely curious about where Beth was and how she got there. So on occasion, a rather intense exchange on politics would surface as we made our way down the coast. It was like an episode of The View crossed with a car commercial. I remember we talked about Hillary Clinton, of course, and immigration and race. It was like the greatest hits of polarized politics with the greatest hits of Reba, Shania, and Trisha playing in the background. We didn't solve anything on that trip. My dad ended the day just as devoted to Trump as when he began, and I ended it just as disgusted with Trump as when we began. It was fun, and it was also stressful, which can describe almost every single family gathering, in my opinion. However, it was Beth's observation afterward that helped me see my dad and our relationship with new eyes. She said after watching us in the car for all those hours, she realized that my dad and I had different expectations when it came to conflict. I expected the presence of conflict and was fine holding the tension of that disagreement. I knew she was right. I don't expect us to come to a compromise and agreement when we talk politics. I would be lying if I said I don't want to influence my dad, but I have no expectation of fundamentally changing him or his opinions when it comes to Trump or anything else political. However, she also said that my dad did not expect the presence of conflict, and therefore the tension of the disagreement was really hard on him. Not until she pointed that out did I realize how right she was. My dad seems genuinely confused and hurt when I see things differently than him. He uses the word disrespect a lot. He often thinks I'm angry with him when I'm not. It is as if he expects a healthy relationship to not have any conflict. Unfortunately, that's not how I operate. Since that trip, I've tried to remember that our political disagreement doesn't exist in a vacuum. Like Reba and Garth on the best road trip, our different expectations of each other are always playing in the background.
Before we belong to ourselves, we belong to the people who raise us. Before we can form the conscious thoughts that are the building blocks of our identity, we belong to our parents and to our families of origin. Belonging to our families of origin is that first connection. It is the sense that we belong as members of this, our first and most important group. Belonging is essential because we are dependent on our families for our very survival. As babies, that belonging is as basic as food and shelter. But if we learn the importance of belonging through our dependence on our families as vulnerable infants, we soon realize that belonging to our families also meets deeper and more complicated emotional needs. Belonging helps us find value in life, cope with painful experiences, improve our motivation, and know that we aren't alone. It all starts with our families. From the people who raise us, we learn what to value, how to be in relationships, and what patterns of behavior help us thrive. The warmth, security, and boundaries of our caregivers shape our development in conscious and unconscious ways for the rest of our lives. If we have siblings, they shape our understanding of our own strengths, our conflict styles, and our resilience. Our families of origin make us who we are, and that's why a breakdown in those connections hurts so badly. Although it always feels unique, personal, and urgent, political conflict within families is not new. These conflicts have long been fertile ground for storytellers and screenwriters. Political divisions have been depicted in Shakespearean drama, in the Bunkers battling over civil rights on All in the Family, and in Alex P. Keaton's decision to join the Reagan Revolution on Family Ties. Today, shows like Black-ish tackle complex and conflicting generational attitudes toward colorism and other issues of identity. And yet, as much as America loves stories about familial conflict, we don't do a very good job showing how to work through those conflicts. There's no laugh track in real life to get us through awkward moments at the dinner table when our great aunt says something racist. There are no closing credits to cue us into a neat and tidy resolution to the latest fight over a viral YouTube video. We need something in the era of the politicization of everything, because our families of origin are suffering under the increased weight of partisanship and identity politics. These disagreements have very real consequences. Identity politics are not theoretical, and our politics increasingly say something meaningful about how we value each other. When politics represents who we are, what does it mean when our family disagrees with us? These are the most heartbreaking stories we hear from our community. Fathers who seem like strangers to their daughters. Sons who slowly shut their parents out of their lives. Mothers who wield shame as a weapon to assure party loyalty. Siblings who no longer speak. People who are not accepted as who they are by the people who gave them life. When these divisions infect our families, it can create a crisis around our sense of belonging. It can feel like a problem that we must solve, and in the process, we can create and endure an enormous amount of suffering. We receive more emails every week about navigating political conflict within families than any other topic. People want us to tell them how to fix it, and we dearly wish we could. We wish we had a formula, an elixir, some way to prescribe adjustments to an attitude here and to media consumption there so that the wheels of communication start turning again. People aren't machines, and the tension among us isn't a math problem. Instead of trying to fix the partisan divides in our families, we are working to try to see them better. We're trying to lift ourselves out of the present, where we're mired in sadness and anger and disbelief, so that we can better understand the dynamics. What's really going on?
Different experiences mean different expectations. A decent percentage of our email might as well have the subject line, insert politician or pundit name, is wrecking my family. Whether it's about who we voted for, which cable news channel we default to, or what podcast host gets our listening time, individuals representing partisan positions tend to capture our imaginations and with them, our identities. In our families, this identification leads to conversations and text threads that look like,
how could you possibly listen to this garbage?
How could you not? You're missing everything. All caps conversations are rarely helpful. But as we're going to learn over and over in this book, we're actually having two conversations at once. We're not just talking about commentators or channels. We're talking about our relationship with each other and how we're showing up in it. We are working out our conflict styles as much as we are working out our political differences. Some of the disconnection within our families of origin that feels like political disagreement can best be understood as generational conflict. Sometimes when we're raging over a certain politician or commentator, we're actually fighting about different expectations. Lindsay Pollack, an expert on the multi-generational workplace, has spent years examining generations and how they interact, not just in the U.S., but around the globe. "I don't think there's any fundamental way that we are different as human beings for being in different generations," she says. "It just changes your expectations." Unfortunately, the prolific media coverage of cross-generational conflict often leaves the expectations of each group unexamined. It's never that one generation has different understandings and expectations surrounding race or gender or work, but rather that one generation has an opinion that the other generation sees as wrong. Not to mention, not everyone in a generation feels the exact same way about everything. We were born the same year as Beyoncé, but as much as we secretly believe we share a lot in common with Queen Bee, we recognize the babies of 1981 are not a monolith any more than the babies of 1964. Fostering generational conflict might make for some good memes and Saturday Night Live sketches, but oversimplifying that conflict is not serving us. We're missing out on important information about each other. "Okay, boomer," or eye-rolling about Gen Z deprives us of critical context about each other's histories, cohorts, and personal stories. The beauty of each individual human experience is both its uniqueness and its mystery. We will never understand what it was like to birth us, feed us, change our diapers, and send us to timeout. This leaves a certain formative amount of loved ones' perspectives unknowable to us. It also leaves us blind to what we can know about the experiences of our caregivers and siblings. How often do we think about how our mother's military service might give her a different perspective on authority than we have? When do we stop to consider whether a brother's concern about our job change reflects the insecurity associated with a traumatic childhood experience? It's easy to forget that our grandparents' experiences in the 1960s informed their perspectives on movements like Occupy Wall Street and Defund the Police. Instead of naming what we know and don't know about each other, many of us tend to operate from the unarticulated expectation that every person in our family shared the same experiences we had and processed those experiences the same way. When we operate from that assumption, it's disorienting that a sibling prefers Fox News to our MSNBC, or that our aunt who raised us voted for the Senate candidate we can't stand. The more we can name what we know about all the factors that shape us as people, the more light we can shine on the origins of our political differences. And here's a bonus. The act of telling stories is one of the most connecting experiences we can have. Most of us are bursting with stories we'd love for someone to listen to, perhaps for the 15th time. Even painful, largely untold stories can forge beautiful bonds. These differences extend far beyond our individual experiences. If you feel like your baby boomer father or your Generation Z daughter lives in a different reality, you're not wrong. Our grandmothers grew up without television and with the profound fallout of World War II and the Great Depression, hence best grandmother recycling pieces of aluminum foil. Our parents grew up without the internet and came of age during the traumatic upheaval of the 1960s. Our children will ride in self-driving cars, will view 9/11 as a distant historic event, and will have few, if any, memories of the Trump administration or the COVID-19 pandemic.
Making the connection. If you're struggling in a relationship with a family member, spend a moment making a list of things you know about that person. When you look at that list, do you see points that might create a deeper connection between you? Do you see points that might be the source of your differing perspectives? What happens when you do this same exercise while considering a family member you feel genuinely close to?
We expect to argue differently or not argue at all. The timing of our births influences so many of our expectations about the world. It also influences our expectations surrounding conflict itself. Where should conflict be present? How should we deal with it? What does conflict mean inside a close family relationship?
When I was 11 3/4, I would have insisted, my parents had a second child. My beloved sister Kimberly went to kindergarten the year I went to college. On September 11th, 2001, I was a junior in college who watched the second plane crash into the World Trade Center and called my dad to ask him what it meant for the world. Kimberly was not yet 9 years old. I logged into my first email account as a senior in high school. Kimberly had an online profile from elementary school. The external world isn't the only sphere of profound differences for the two of us. Our mom threw softballs and jumped on the trampoline with me. When Kimberly was young, Mom was in the early stages of a severe rheumatoid arthritis diagnosis. Our grandmother Joy was my best friend and constant companion growing up. Kimberly would say the same of her, but we experienced very different versions of Grandmother Joy because of the impacts of dementia. Kimberly grew up with cousins that I barely know. I remember relatives she never met. I think I saw Kimberly as my baby sister until she was well into adulthood. After all, I loaded her up in my Mercury Topaz and took her to preschool every day. I was in a car accident my junior year of high school that was in some ways a defining event in my life. 5-year-old Kimberly was in the back seat. We experienced that event literally and figuratively from very different seats. When I went to college, Kimberly visited me with dolls in tow. When she went to college, she brought her laundry to my house and babysat my daughter. It wasn't until she married, moved to Chicago, renovated a house, and had her own child that I started seeing her as a peer. Kimberly and I didn't learn to fight with each other. Because of our age difference, my sister and I didn't have that childhood laboratory of working out disagreements over toys and activities and who hogs the bathroom mirror. I wouldn't change a single dimension of our relationship. Well, I do wish she would move into my neighborhood, but other than that. And yet, as I watch my daughters, who are only 4 years apart, duke it out every day over the swings and shoes and who touched this coloring book, I find myself wondering what Kimberly and I missed about how to vigorously argue with people and love them anyway. Sometimes I wonder how our lack of practice with conflict will play out as we get older and life gets harder. We love each other fiercely. Do we know how to argue with each other if we truly disagree when difficult decisions about our parents' health or property have to be made? I know we can work through these things. Also, I'm already thinking about how to show Kimberly that I'm her peer. When it's time to make those critical, complex choices, I don't want to be in the big sister role. I want us to be two equals, working together to figure out the best path forward for our family.
Some of us grow up in households where sharp words are never uttered. Some of us grow up in households where language and dishes fly. In some households, an argument means prolonged periods of silence and the withholding of affection. In others, raised voices are quickly followed by laughter. In some families, it's seen as completely disrespectful to question an elder. In others, it's seen as intellectually lazy to accept all family orthodoxy. The unwritten rules around who we argue with and how we have those arguments are the results of generations of patterns. These patterns create a set of expectations that we, too, frequently forget to discuss. It's helpful to remember when political topics come up that we are talking about and working on so much more than policy, electoral, or even cultural disagreement. We might be talking about Obamacare, but we are talking around our different understandings of the world and different expectations about conflict.
Making the connection. We want to stop talking around those different expectations and start getting to the heart of our disagreements. One way to do that is through storytelling. When we ask each other open-ended and unexpected questions, we can learn more about what's behind the opinions and emotions that can make some of our closest relationships so difficult. As a few examples, if you're talking to a family member about immigration and are surprised at the distance between your stances, you might say, "Isn't it interesting that we grew up in the same place, went to church together, know lots of the same people, and still see this so differently? I wonder if there's an experience you remember having that really impacted your views on this."
If you're talking about critical race theory, you might say, "What is the most important thing you learned about race in school?"
If you're talking about social welfare programs and how much money should be invested in them, you might say, "How have you thought about some of the toughest times in your life? Where have you received the most help? When you haven't received much help, how has that impacted you?"
Parent-child relationships are filled with unspoken expectations. We have another set of usually unarticulated expectations around why we create families in the first place. It's changed dramatically over time. Both our motivation for having families and our expectations of roles within families have shifted from biological imperative and economic necessity to something more like self-fulfillment and the creation of idyllic childhoods. We're not looking for help on the farm or in the family
Sample complete. Ready to continue?